What's up, everybody? We're here for Mudball Monday. Let's just assume that Surratt is in. Like, the deal's done, and we'll see him appear, whether it's Mayakoba or later. I'm not sure. You know, the biggest team guy of them all is Perez. That guy rides for the team model.
If we talk about the team model, Pat Perez has been cleaning up. Is Anthony Kim not the perfect Malbon golf guy?
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah.
With every player successively that goes to live and deepens the competitive pool on that tour, it becomes less and less of a joke. Now, I don't know where we're at. Good morning, good evening, good day. Welcome back to Mudball Monday, episode 119. I am Henry Schimpf. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Walker Simas. We are talking today about professional golf, amateur golf, Brothers 54, PGA Tour, a lot of crazy shit going on these days. We got people defecting. We got people coming out of retirement, I guess you could say, Yetiism.
Long vacations,
we got a lot of things going on.
Tectonic plates are shifting.
We got Matthew Pavon winning on the PGA Tour yesterday. I'd never heard of him before. I don't follow the game that closely, but I mean, I'm in the top decile, I would have to imagine, of kind of understanding of professional golf. And it's pretty rare that someone's going to poke up and win a PGA Tour event that I've like never heard of. And there we are. So before we get into all that, of course, Mr. Walker Simas, welcome to the episode, and we'll get to the dirt. How about you lead us off with what you've been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking in the last week?
What up? What up? Drinking. It was a bender yesterday. We had Gasparilla in Tampa, Florida. Everything's Gasparilla. It's like growing up in Charlotte. Everything's Myers Park. Everything's Gasparilla here. This is my
Peach
third
Tree
one.
In Atlanta.
Yeah, exactly. I think everywhere has this, but got into a hefty amount of rum punch yesterday. So that was kind of what I was drinking on the alcohol category. Dude, it was a bender of a day. Just cleansing myself with Mudball Half Calf this morning.
Yes.
Admittedly, I would have gone straight for the South American Dark this morning, but I'm out. So what it's resulted in is just a ton of Mudball Half Calf, which I'm not entirely mad at. And then, of course, electrolytes, shout out to Redmond's Real Salt. It's been good on the drinking front this week, so things are tight. Eating, I'm doing.
Hey, for those that are curious, Mudball Half Calf, what's the deal? You know, where should they go? What should they do? Let's make sure everyone's dialed here.
Great question. No, Mudball Half Calf is just an essential part of my week. It's on par with water and showering. It's just something that has become a necessity. Good Walk Coffee is the company. Our good friends at Good Walk Coffee. I'll be reaching out to them this week for some South American Dark. And I highly recommend doing the same at goodwalkcoffee.com. You can use code THETIE, that is THETIE, for 20% off of your coffee order. Whatever you like, not just limited to the Mudball Half Calf, which we recommend. But also try a few other blends as well. So thanks for helping me out there. Eating. Henry, you're going to like this. I miss Chipotle. I'm going to let you do with that what you want, but I miss Chipotle. And so this week I'm deciding to do it myself the right way. And so this week, after we get off recording today, I'm going to get in there and get situated on the bowl situation. This is how
this
I'm
sounds like a reel.
This sounds like a reel. It might be a reel. You're watching this in real form. I am going to take inspiration from the prep, the way that Chipotle does their prep. So I'm going to make my cilantro lime rice. I'm going to make my proteins maybe 2 days out. I don't think I'm going to go any more than 2 days. I've got some onions and peppers situation. I'm going to do some like cilantro lime corn. I've got some salsas. So that's the vibe. I'm going to go different containers for each and just kind of build my bowls Monday through Wednesday. And I'm very excited to report how that goes. So that is kind of my eating focus this week. I miss Chipotle, but I want the control of doing it myself. That's it. Reading. I'm closing out the Hacking of the American Mind this week. I got into really the final four chapters end of this week, and it was about the four C's. Very interesting. And as I've discussed in recent Mudball Mondays, this book talks a lot about sugar and the way big food markets food us, what it does to our brains. I mean, we've talked about Big Blueberry and the STEM situation with Big Berry. This is bigger. This is
bigger than Big Blueberry.
This is bigger than Big Blueberry, I'm
That's
afraid
big.
To say.
Fuck.
Yet the four C's talked about more of the application, more of like wrapping up a book of, hey, here's a bunch of bad stuff that you kind of hoped wasn't going on. But towards the end of the book, like, here's what you do with this. And the four C's were connection, contribution, coping, which was kind of a weird one. Coping is
and
more
coffee,
like
coffee.
I wish. Well, you can put that in the coping category, I guess.
Okay.
Sleep would also fall in the coping category, kind of like what makes the world go round in a way. And then cooking. So you can figure out where coffee goes in that. Regardless, I guess the whole idea is that the government or entities or companies sell pleasure. But actually, the decisions that you make are the only things that can form happiness. And the contrast between pleasure and happiness is a lot of what is talked about in this book, and applying sort of the decisions you make going for real happiness, something of substance, versus pleasure, something that you can buy, something that's very transactional. Applying that way of thinking to connection, contribution, coping, and cooking was kind of how the book wrapped up. And I thought that was pretty unique. The way that I think it's Robert Lusting, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. I love the way he goes through his chapters, because he'll open up, let's say, connection, for example. And then there will be kind of 15 little sub chapters within that chapter where he goes off on tangents and hyper focuses on a couple of things within that. I've really enjoyed the book. I think come December it'll be a top tenner. So wrapping up reading, going into thinking, I had a conversation with somebody after a couple rounds of Rum Punch, and we were talking about Charlotte and Atlanta and even Austin as far as what the cost of cities growing is. Like, it's not bad. Growth is generally good for most people. However, with growth, there are some things that diminish a city, things that the city used to have that it doesn't have anymore. So it was cool. We were just talking about where I was from, and I mentioned Austin. The city planning in Austin is unusual in this sense, where you could have a like a mom and pop store next to a gas station, next to an art museum. And that I found that super cool. Usually in bigger cities, you get this concentration of commercial or residential or whatever. So I thought that was great.
Can I jump in briefly?
Yeah, go.
What you, as a real estate guy, what you're kind of getting at here is the concept of zoning, or potential lack thereof. Zoning in Texas is known to be very low key, if at all. Houston is the real poster child here, where there's truly like no city zoning whatsoever. And so, you know, the consummate example people will give is you'll get, you know, a lingerie shop next to a church, which, you know, those things are maybe clashing a bit. But anyway, on you go.
But the clashing is part of the human experience. And when things are too sectioned off, at times it can feel not as artistic, not as real, not as random. And I think randomness is something that's really important. Nonetheless, it got me thinking about a trip that I took on Friday, which was to Orlando. And I guess my whole point of this whole thinking category is that Orlando is my version of hell. There is no resemblance of nature at all. It is so congested. It takes forever to get in and out of there. Everything inside of there is uninspiring and takes too long and only 90 degree angles. Over marketed, underperforms. It's just the worst. I avoid it at any chance I take. And I went to the PGA show this week, and I was thinking, man, I really need to go. And I couldn't swing it Monday through Thursday, and got tickets for Friday. And I thought, you know, I know it's going to be a little bit dead. I'll go. We'll have a couple conversations that will make it worth going to. And show was just dead on Friday. Like, everybody was packing up their stuff. And it really bummed me out. I look forward next year and the year after and the year after to go and do the PGA show right, because just looking at the bones of it, I think it's an awesome deal where people get to interact and pause for a little bit. Like, everybody's doing such great stuff out in the world of golf, and to be able to be in the same room with those people is really cool. I just felt like I showed up at the scene a little bit too late and sat in 7 hours of traffic for it. So depressing way to end my dirt here. Henry, I'm going to toss it back to you. What do you got?
Yeah, I'm going to start off. I don't know that I've done this before. I'm going to do my drinking and my eating as airport edition. So,
okay,
starting off here with my drinking, I'm actually going to hit on two things that I'm not drinking when it comes to the airport. And that is, I'm shorting airport coffees. Now, if it's early morning, like, it has to be done. You know, when you have that 6 a.m., 7 a.m. flight and you get to the airport an hour and a half early, like, the coffee has to happen. But let's say it's not like a necessity coffee. You either are getting ready to or have just dehydrated yourself being on an airplane. Like, coffee is probably not the best decision. Leading into the second thing that I'm putting a full Michael Burry short on, which is airport beers. And I know that this is an unpopular opinion, but I'm just not an airport beers guy. Like, I like beer, but I like beer as something that is had in an enjoyable setting, you know, with other people that I enjoy being around. And an airport is quite antithetical to that, I would say. So although I am long as hell on coffee and at worst holding on beer, when it comes to airports, I'm placing a short call on each of those. Now, I'm going to move on from there to my eating and talk about two places, two particular airports with two particular restaurants that I quite fancy, because I think airport food in a general sense is like pretty tough scene. You know, I don't do a lot of eating in airports. I think I try to avoid that and eat elsewhere. But anytime I travel through the great Austin Bergstrom International Airport, I always hit up my friends at the Taco Deli. Whether it's breakfast tacos or lunch or dinner tacos, they are putting out a good service at the Taco Deli. Now, that is my all-time gamer. When it comes to something new to me, there's a bit of an institution in Orange County known as Broderd's. It's a Vietnamese place known for having just some of the best spring rolls anywhere, certainly the best I've ever had. Been there a time or two and everything's good, but particularly the spring rolls. There's a new Broderd's Express in the SNA John Wayne Irvine Airport. And I would say in a general sense that if you see like a big sort of restaurant that then does like an airport version, that's probably not the way to go. But I saw it and I was like, okay, I can't not check this out. Dude, they were legit like cooking it up back there, not just like importing stuff in. And I'm telling, so these spring rolls, I think usually when people hear spring roll, they're thinking just like your typical steamed shrimp with vermicelli noodle, rice paper, you know, all that sort of stuff, which is good. Broderd's, I've had in the three or four times I've been, I can recall steamed shrimp, grilled pork, ribeye, eggplant, breakfast, which is like a breakfast, not what you're thinking of, but like a Asian breakfast sausage and egg. There's an asparagus avocado. They have like five or six different sauces that they do with these spring rolls. I mean, it would be like, you know, like likening this to the general spring roll you're going to see. It would be like if the only pizza you've ever experienced was like Domino's cheese pizza. There's nothing wrong with that. It's pretty decent. And then you show up to like a great like New York or Neapolitan style place that's got all this stuff going on. You're like, this is a different, This is a different food right here. So Broadridge Express, anyone who flies through SNA, please, please go hit some spring rolls for me. That is my eating category, airport edition, Taco Deli and Broadridge Express. I like things wrapped up. Do with that as you may. Moving on to my reading. I started this week, The Gambler by Billy Walters. Thoroughly enjoying that book so far. I guess Billy Walters is kind of the most prolific gambler of all time, more or less, both in sports and in the markets, in real estate, all sorts of different things. He has done plenty of gambling in his day, golf gambling. So he's the guy that when Phil got on the hot seat a handful of years back for insider trading, it was with his Billy Walters relationship. And I'm only about 40 pages in, so I'm not there yet. But on the cover of the book, or I guess like the inside cover where you get kind of the Cliff Notes version, he goes out and says that if Phil would have taken a stand during his trial, Walters ended up serving like 20, 30 months in prison or something like that on a 5-year sentence. And he says, like, literally on the inside cover of the book, if Phil would have just taken a stand, that never would have happened. So I am curious to see how our boy Phil makes his way into this story, because I think it'll be rather interesting. So that'll wrap up my reading. Finally, my thinking, and I'll use this as a nice little footbridge straight into our episode here on Pro Golf today. We got the Brothers 54 bucking their head, poaching amateurs, poaching European players. I guess they're teeing off this week in Mayakoba. We got the PGA Tour having, you know, great amateurs turning pro. We got events ending on Saturday. We got all sorts of stuff going on. We got guys coming out of the woodwork, AK. I'm just sitting here, like, adding it all up, checking my lists. Where is the TGL? Like, it can't be pro golf without TGL. So I've been thinking about the TGL. And I think TGL has become kind of the second coming of LIV a little bit, in the sense of, I remember the joke early on LIV is the whole thing was like, just wait. Like, it's coming. It's going to be great. Wait till we get Jeddah. Like, you're just wait. That's kind of what I'm getting on TGL. You know, it's like, they're like, seriously, it's going to be awesome. You're going to love it. Just hold on. Just wait. And I'm like, I'm waiting. And there's just nothing. No one's even talking about TGL. You know, I haven't even seen anybody hit balls into a simulator on a Thursday night. Like, I don't know what to think here. So TGL, where are we at? That's the question, essentially.
TGL feels like, you know, if you're into marble racing, and I don't know if anybody here is into marble racing, but you got to pick a couple marbles, right? You got to put some money on a couple of them and say, hey, you know, two or three of you aren't going to make me very happy tonight, but one of you is going to make it worth my while.
So quick pause before we get into the episode. You do need to explain your relationship with marble racing, and no bullshit here, because I think I have a better sense of what you're up to on the weekends these days.
Oh, brother, I've never marble raced in my life. It was just the best analogy. Now, that is not to say that it's not in my future. I don't know. Could go to Bangladesh and put some American dollars on a marble race and I'm all in, but no marble racing yet to this day. I just feel like TGL is one of those things where, you know, you're sitting in one of those boardrooms. We can't let LIV win. What are our best options? TGL was kind of a back of the napkin idea. They put a bunch of money into it, and very quickly the writing was on the wall. This isn't going to be the thing that breaks up this party. And so I wouldn't be entirely surprised if it just gets abandoned altogether. The talks with LIV and PGA Tour, I know that's more, not exactly just LIV, but something else is going to be the catalyst of change. It's not going to be TGF. Fucking continents.
It's not going to be TGL. It is not going to be TGL. We know that. Okay,
good try,
let's move
though.
On. Let's get into a little PGA Tour, a little LIV. So we've got kind of four players, buckets of players that we're going to talk about today, almost in a little bit of a show and tell format. So Mr. Dr. Freshwater Simus has two people in particular that he has done some research on throughout the week. Make sure he's dialed. Likewise for myself. And I'll let you start it off here. I want to hear first off, what do you know? What do the people need to know? That's what we're here for. We are here to inform Los people of Mudball Monday. What do they need to know about Caleb Surratt?
Caleb,
in normal person talk, that's Caleb Surratt.
That's right. For those of you who don't know Caleb quite as well, I mean, he kind of grew up in around our hometown. He's a Monroe kid, just outside of Charlotte. He went to Union Academy, kind of a 1A high school, currently 19 years old, and is the 10th ranked Wagger amateur in the world. An incredible talent, and somebody who anybody who has a decent gauge for what, you know, like a good eye test, you know, anybody who can walk out into a, you know, 10 competitive events and say, that guy's got the sauce. Caleb's got the sauce, objectively. He's always been a little bit different. And the rumor about Caleb is that he is making the jump to John Rahm's team on LIV Golf. So let's talk about that for a little bit. So there was an X account, Handicap 54, who made the tweet originally. And what was picked off first was that Surratt had a spot in the Dubai Desert Classic that got filled by somebody else. Like, strange. Why isn't he going over there? And rumor is Rahm's team, Legion 13, is getting filled with not only Surratt, but Wyndham Clark and one
I
other.
I saw that.
And I'm a little bit perplexed by that. I'm going to give you some room here before we get deeper on Surratt stuff, but do you see Wyndham on that team? Does that seem entirely accurate to you?
I think Wyndham is, I'm going to choose my words carefully here or not carefully. I think Wyndham's more of an ass clown version of Taylor Gooch, in that, like, Taylor Gooch is, he's definitely kind of a dipshit, but he's obviously a great golfer, and he's just been drinking too much Kool-Aid with the whole LIV stuff, the, you know, the Ryder Cup comment and all of the stuff that's gone on. It's like, Taylor, like, you just sound dumb, you know, just like, let's think a little bit here. I think that actually, okay, so Gooch may have been the wrong example. I think Wyndham is basically going to be the second coming of Bryson DeChambeau on LIV, just so, like,
in on
what's
the model,
the right term? Yeah, just power. Like, exactly. Just so zealous about the whole thing. And you're just kind of looking at him, you're like, brother, like, you took the money, and like, it's fine. It's all fine. But I don't need you to sit here and like try to feed me, like force feed me the Kool-Aid that you're drinking, you know?
Yeah.
When we talk, we like to talk about our feelings on Mudball Monday. Getting into my feelings about Wyndham Clark going to LIV Golf, like, I feel nothing. I feel precisely nothing. So, yeah, kind of like, yeah, you take it. Now, signaling wise, what this means for the broader landscape, I mean, yeah, he's the current U.S. Open champion. He's clearly a really fantastic golfer, and it's another feather in their cap. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it doesn't really do a whole lot for me.
So I go two ways with this, and I want to get back to Caleb here shortly, but there's been this Phil approach, this DJ approach, this Gooch approach, all of which are turnoffs to me as far as making LIV a product that I want to watch. Like, the golf isn't world class inherently because we don't have the best players playing against each other on the same fields outside of the majors. So what do we want at that point? We just want great entertainment. And, you know, Phil's been very quiet. We understand why that is. Gooch has been very obnoxious. I guess we understand why that is. DJ, for example, like a guy that I loved watching to play golf and had a little bit
biggest
of
casualty of LIV, as I said a couple weeks ago.
Right, exactly. But had a little bit of life in him before he went to LIV, and now is just kind of like a bit of a ghost, to be honest. And it makes me wonder, let's just assume that Surratt is in, like, the deal's done and we'll see him appear, whether it's Mayakoba or later, I'm not sure. What approach do these guys take to it? Is the only equilibrium point, like, LIV amassing a bunch of players who are good enough to for us to us being the golf fans say, hey, LIV's legit now. Is it an entertainment product until LIV is legit? I'm not sure. But it'll be interesting to see how Caleb approaches it. Like, he'll be 20 years old. He's just going to go out and try and play a bunch of great golf, but how does he embrace the team model? I'm not sure. That's all going to be interesting to watch. Regardless, I do want to dig into his background a little bit, because I feel like with Nick Dunlap, there's been so much attention on what he's done. Obviously, U.S. Junior, U.S. Amateur, there's been a lot of coverage on Dunlap, but not as much on Surratt. And he's kind of gotten the second place handle. He's kind of been in the shadows a little bit up until this point. 10th in Wagger, as I said, he's had some experience on the PGA Tour. Three starts, only one cut. T65 was his best in Bermuda. He's a killer, though. He crushed in the Walker Cup, won three out of the 4 points that he could. First team All-America, individual SEC champ. And then the time where I really got a hold of him was the U.S. Amateur, where he placed runner-up at Bandon Dunes.
U.S. Junior.
Sorry, U.S. Junior. My bad. It just really good stuff. What do you think the number? What kind of number are we talking for?
So,
how do you evaluate a 19-year-old?
Yeah, I mean,
it's kind of like
someone,
a 13-year-old college commit in a way,
right? Someone who go unnamed tipped us off a little while back on he heard from a very close friend of Surratt's this was likely to happen, and the number I heard was only a few million, which I don't know. Like, I guess I can see that being an amateur. I also just like for only that. And I know that there's a lot of money to be made out there. And also these contracts, a lot of them by nature, we'll get into this with Anthony Kim, are dynamic in how they're proposed. And so it could very well be like, hey, like, you're only 19, you're an amateur, we'll sign you for this, you know, come play for a year. If you are like the eighth guy on the tour after a year, like, okay, we'll sign you for another 5 or 6 years and you're going to get that bag, as they say. I could very well see that, because for only a few million dollars, like, this is a guy that should be looking at himself and saying like, shit, I could win the U.S. Amateur this year, whatever. And I mean, I might pull that in by the time I turn pro just off of NIL money. But you know, that's the number I heard. So I think, kind of sidestepping here and giving a quick thought of my own on Surratt, like, you know, I don't fault him or anybody else. Like, people can truly do whatever the hell they want. No one cares on earth what I have to say. But this is, to me, maybe the most below the belt play that LIV has made thus far, poaching a 19-year-old amateur. I just think it's going to suck. You're saying it'll be interesting to see how Caleb approaches the whole thing. To see a guy like that turn into just the newest LIV propagandist will be pretty damning, I would say. Who knows? I mean, you made a good comment there, and I'll use this as a segue to move into my first sort of piece here today on Tyrrell Hatton and Adrian Meronk. But I think that it's important to check in on, like, where are we at on the continuum of LIV being kind of a joke versus, like, look, let's take the extreme example. If every single player in the world, professional golfer in the world, ended up being on the LIV tour, then it's no longer a joke. It's pro golf. And unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you see it, it's been purchased essentially by the Saudis. But that is pro golf, and it's not some joke. With every player successively that goes to LIV and deepens the competitive pool on that tour, it becomes less and less of a joke. Now, I don't know where we're at on that right now, if it's becoming essentially synonymous with the PGA Tour from the level of competition, et cetera. But we're getting closer and closer, and two more feathers in their cap are Adrian Meronk and Tyrrell Hatton. Now, Tyrrell is still, to some degree, speculative. I mean, we're recording here on Sunday, January the 28th, by tomorrow. I mean, very well, it could be out, like, formally. I think that what we do know is that we're going to know for sure who these final players are by Friday when they tee off in Mexico, and realistically, you know, Thursday. I think they play practice rounds on the Live Tour. I could be wrong there. They might just kind of
fucking knows.
They might just do concerts and whatnot.
They might just spin them through a video game and say, "You guys got the course? You got that dogleg left par four?"
The whole thing could just be a simulation, if we're being honest. Anyway, that aside, we should know here pretty soon. But Maronk, to my knowledge, it might be Maronk, not Maronk, but I enjoy saying Maronk better, so I'm going to keep going with that hard O. He's gone, as far as I understand. And Hatton, you know, just the height of being duplicitous over the last couple of weeks. He was asked recently, where's he out on Liv? You know, obviously Tommy was alleged at potentially going Liv, and Tommy pretty candidly said, yes, I received an offer, and no, I did not accept said offer. Tyrrell kind of took the route of, yeah, they've been talking to some guys. Yes, I am on that list. We'll see what happens. And the follow-up was, well, that seems pretty up in the air to me. You know, are you happy with being on tour? What's going to happen? And he said, yes, I'm happy for now. And I think the follow-up there was, well, for now, that seems as if maybe there's a change coming, and basically gave it a, we'll see. So I'd love to play a little high-stakes poker with Tyrrell Hatton, because I think I could walk away with a pretty penny based on those responses. So seems to me as if both the 39th player in Maronk, 39th ranked player in the world, as well as the 16th ranked player in the world in Tyrrell Hatton are becoming brother 54. And I mentioned my feelings on Wyndham Clark. More of the same here. I mean, Adrian Maronk was the snub of the European or potentially American Ryder Cup team as well this past year. Did not make the European team and was voted DP World Tour Player of the Year by his peers. Those things seem to be, you know, kind of a juxtaposition there at a pretty high level. But I frankly don't really care that much for Adrian Maronk. I'm not saying I don't like him. It's just like, he doesn't do much for me. I think that he and Hatton being a higher ranked player, and, you know, he's kind of enjoyable in certain ways, but frankly, the whole like pissy nature of Tyrrell Hatton doesn't do very much for me. Some people might really enjoy it, but I'm not really there for it.
Can we unpack that briefly?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious about Hatton. There seems to be this transfer when, especially initially, when Liv got started. You know, you get your bag, you know, you scuffle over to Liv, you stay in nicer hotels. It doesn't matter what you shoot on a week-to-week basis. You know, Hatton is a great player. I mean, no denying that he's a great player, but the wins are quite light, we could say. How does that affect him at Liv? Does the happiness factor have a lot of weight here? Does he go off and win a bunch of events? Happy Tyrrell's a good golfer. Angry Tyrrell's a bad, bad man. So how do you see that unfolding?
I mean, I'll dip into the Matt Wolf playbook and say it's never felt better to shoot 75. So maybe Happy Tyrrell is just a 75 guy. They're all 54 guys. We know that. I don't know. He could become like the next Taylor Gooch. He could be the British Taylor Gooch. Like, couldn't quite get it over the line on the PGA Tour. Clearly a great player, has a lot of game. Tyrrell, I mean, I'm sure he's one of those guys. I'm not sure, but I feel as if he's probably one of those guys that low-key has a good handful of DP World Tour wins. Mm-hmm. I'm quite confident he won the 2022. No, Scheffler won the 22 Arnold Palmer. Maybe it was just last year that Tyrrell won the Arnold Palmer. I do believe that he won that one, signature event, big win. Maybe 21, but yeah, I think it was Scheffler that got 22, and then it was either 21 or 23 that Hatton won. So he has won, but yeah, it's an interesting call out that he could be one of those guys that goes over and either plays really good golf or maybe not such good golf. Now, when it comes to, I think one of the things that interests me with each of these guys is I think Maronk and Hatton, they are definitely on the dark horse list of like guys we would be looking at for major championships, you know, whether that's the Masters or any of them. Like, these are not guys that you're picking to win if you only get two or three horses. But like, if you're a Billy Walters and you're looking for value, I think Tyrrell Hatton's the kind of guy you could see like, okay, those odds don't line up with, you know, being ranked 16th in the world. You know, he is plus way too much to be a guy that allegedly only 15 guys in the world are better than, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I think just closing out my thought on each of those guys and kind of back to where I started, it just begs the question of where are we at on the whole continuum of, with every high level player that they get, you know, I think that top 50, top 100 in the world, that's a pretty good proxy because, I mean, these are each guys who are exempt for the majors this year based on their rankings. I'm not positive when those cutoffs come. But I like the Masters invitation to go out at the beginning of the year. I feel pretty certain that each of them would have received one of those. And that probably is true of the US Open and other events as well. And so, you know, these are guys who, in the grand scheme of things, like I was about to use the term, I think these are both have-nots in the game of golf. Like when you think about things like the PIF and the guys that are like really making a ton of money off course, et cetera, I think these guys are both on the have-nots list. But when it comes to things like getting in the Masters and all, these guys are haves. And Liv's got another couple of them. So we move with each of these players closer and closer to the ultimate relevancy of Liv. And although it, from kind of a cultural standpoint and, you know, how much inherent value there is to the product of Liv, I don't think the needle has moved here, if much at all. But the competitive pool is deeper, without a doubt.
That's worth something. I mean, right now, you mentioned earlier, where are the scales? And I think right now, if this were a seesaw, both tours are in the air, which means that we're fairly balanced. And in that fight to see who's going to win, Liv is making progress. Theoretically, the more people that they have under their tour who are likely to win major championships, that is value right now. And they just added 2-3 plus more. I mean, we'll see with Wyndham and whoever else. Also, past major championships matter. So
yeah, and I mean, the likelihood, I think that's an interesting thing to look at there. Like with every potential major winner that you add to your tour, the likelihood that someone wins a major, I mean, just straight up off of magnitude of guys who could do it, obviously the odds increase, but also the competitive pool increases. And so, you know, kind of the sum of odds that someone's going to end up winning a major from Liv, those odds have gone up by making it just a deeper and deeper pool. And allegedly, they're going to keep this model of, I think they're at more than 48 guys right now, but it's supposed to be a revolving door where with every one of these guys that comes off, we're just one day closer to Richard Bland no longer being on Liv. And
the cliques are going to lose a good one, man. God,
you know, Blandy out, Wyndham in, like, okay, well, it's just more competitive. And, you know, the classic, you're only as good as your weakest link. When that weakest link becomes pretty darn strong, sheesh.
Writing's on the wall. All right, let's talk about Dunlap.
Speaking of strong, Nicholas Dunlap. Wow.
Honestly, there's not a whole lot to say with Dunlap, just because he's been so public in the last few weeks. But just 1 year older than Surratt, 20 years old, was previously a sophomore at Alabama, now on the PGA Tour. What I think is so amazing about this story, one positive thing to share about the PGA Tour, which is no hot take, in that you're just not going to see a win like that mean what it did on a live event, period, end of story. I didn't have the chance to watch Phil's victory as an amateur live. I've obviously seen the rerun of it. I know as well as I can what that must have felt like, but to see it happen in real time with a player that we've more or less been tracking for a couple years, against players that, like Sam Burns, for example, I've been watching Sam Burns play golf for 6 years, 7 years. And Sam's going to continue to make a wake in this game. He's only one example. To see Dunlap just completely break through was really fun to watch. I mean, what a moment that was. The second thing is kind of what led up to it. U.S. junior champion, U.S. amateur champion, all the hurdles and, you know, 7-foot par saves and chip-ins that had to be made in the right moments to simply get to the position where he was number one amateur in the world. He was leading PGA Tour U. He had won the U.S. amateur. He was exempt for the Masters, for the U.S. Open, for the Open. Was probably going to have 7+ PGA Tour starts this year, and then doubles down and earns it all one more time for certainty in a PGA Tour event. What an accomplishment that is. It's one we've seen before, but it's one that I've never seen so closely. And, you know, if we're taking weights here, like what Surratt is allegedly, supposedly about to do, Dunlap counters that. And he puts somebody the same age of equal or more talent, of equal or more potential back onto the PGA Tour side. So you're a little bit flush here, which is a win for the PGA Tour. My next question, and everybody's question, is what does he do this year? I think it's easy to make the argument that Dunlap is, I mean, this may be a big take, but he's following in the footsteps of Justin Thomas, of Jordan Spieth, of Scotty Scheffler, and he's won at every level. He has all the things that you would want, and you're probably looking at a really hot early start to a career, and then some sort of slump in your late 20s, and then get right back after it. I think we've seen that with Spieth. I think we've seen that with Thomas, and I don't think we've seen the slump from Scheffler yet, but I do think Scheffler is human. I do think we will see that eventually. So I'm tracking Dunlap in that sort of echelon. What does that mean? What does he do in 2024? I'm not sure, but I don't think another win is out of the question. I do think we're going to see him compete and compete hard this year. Anything to add there? Anything to poke at?
A few things I'm curious with on Dunlap. I mean, you covered a lot of it there. I'll throw in, like, there's one other guy who has won both the U.S. Junior and the U.S. Amateur, El Cat, who he did each of those things 3 times. So it's just this classic Cat.
It's like, really funny when you put
it. It's like, man, that's like virtually impossible to win the U.S. Junior and the U.S. Amateur. Two guys have done it. And it's like, oh, yeah, that guy Cat, he did it each of them 3 times in a row. You know?
Yeah, and he,
like,
did it 6 years in a row.
It's like, you know, you're talking about, you know, winning each of them is like, you know, flipping heads 32 times in a row or something like that. And then doing each of them 3 times in a row. It's like being able to flip a quarter and have it stand up, you know, 32 times in a row. That's the way Cat plays. Anyway, only other guy in the modern era, really, to win as an amateur on the PGA Tour while in college, like Dunlap did. Phil Mickelson. So Cat and Mickelson, cumulative 21 major championships, if my maths are correct there. That's the company that we're playing with. So pretty good stuff there. I think that the metric I think of, I've used this to kind of liken, like, okay, how good is this amateur? How well might he do on a PGA Tour is the question of, hey, if you gave this guy a card for basically the full year as a 19, 20, 21 year old, whatever you're talking about, like, would he make the tour championship, right? Like, because to me, that's identifying as, like, it's unrealistic to say, like, oh, well, this guy win a major this year. Caleb Surratt thinks that Nick Dunlap will, for what that's worth. Will he win a major this year? Will he do this? Will he do that? Like, to me, that all is just kind of like the jury's out. And it's just like too small of a data point. But if you make the tour championship, you clearly are one of the 30 best players on the PGA Tour in a given year. Honestly, I mean, if you gave me even money odds, I think I probably would bet on Dunlap to do that this year, which that's strong. But I think that's the class of player we're working with. I'm not saying I think he's going to win the thing. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But I think that is kind of where the ceiling is. And I think it'll be really, really interesting to see a guy who is going to come out full year on tour, he'll get into every single event, and like, how good is kind of the top college player, right? Like, we're going to get to see it this year. And I think that's super cool. And that's fun and unique to get to experience. The one question that I have with Nick Dunlap, you know, you talked about the slump that likely will come at some point, all of the things to consider there. As far as I can remember watching him play golf, because I recall that 2021 US Junior at the Country Club of North Carolina, he's always played, I can't recall if it's the left or his right wrist, but he wraps one of his wrists every single time he plays.
I think it's
so clearly we've got a little something going on there, you know, high 180s ball speed, dingers. The guy's in great shape. So a lot of things to be positive about. But we've talked about this before. I talked about this on our pod with Sean Foley about these young guys who have so much speed and, you know, potentially, and I think he has a great frame, but potentially more horsepower than the frame can really handle.
Yeah.
Like if we're 20 years old and have already been playing with a wrapped wrist for multiple years, what's that going to look like? You know, if he's now playing 37 professional events a year, pro-am, 6 days of golf per week, et cetera. That's the only question I have about Nick Dunlap is, will he be able to physically stand up to the rigors of being a professional golfer? I kind of hate saying that because I really want to be, I want this to be the tiniest blip ever of like guy made comment and total bullshit. The guy won 4 majors and, you know, have fun. But, I'm monitoring that situation.
Fair thing to monitor. I mean, I think at what point do you say, hey, wraps are preventative to some nature? Like, I don't know. I don't know about Nick's wrist, and he's fast. There's no doubt. I like his golf swing. Like, I think he gets out of the way properly. I don't see, it's not like Waco with the spine. You know, I look at Joaquin Neiman and I'm like, man, you know, you put 300,000 miles on that golf swing and I'm not liking what he's feeling.
Yeah.
But with Nick, I say, you know, maybe.
Hey, speaking of wrists, Anthony Kim.
Get right into it, Henry Schimp. Come on.
Fuck, he's back. Okay, so here's what I've gathered. He's 38 years old.
Give me the scoop.
He last competed on the PGA Tour at the Wells Fargo in 2012, nearly 12 years ago, at the age of 26. It was thumb, wrist sort of tendonitis that was catching up to him, and guy just couldn't go anymore. Obviously had the reputation of being a spark plug, liked to get after it off the course. I think there was a lot in that situation, but the injuries being the main thing. Well, the guy takes out an insurance policy, which he had done, you know, he did prior, kind of knowing that he had some physical ailments. And the whole thing has been like, he's not been playing pro golf because it's not that he probably couldn't have done this 7 years ago, right? Like it doesn't take 12 years to recover from an injury. But he's had this insurance policy that people have said is somewhere between worth $10 and $20 million, that says if you ever hit another shot on the PGA Tour, you have to pay back these monthly payments that you've been getting on this insurance policy. Well, reading between the lines here, and we'll talk about the other tour that could probably make those problems go away real fast. There's just so much money. Not that there wasn't money back when Anthony Kim was first playing on the PGA Tour, but there's so much money in golf these days that I think he's looking at and saying like, yeah, man, if I decide that I'm playing pro golf, considering the sort of sponsorship money I'm going to get, things like the PIF, the fact that just like, if you're 18th on the money list on the PGA Tour, I should be more dialed on these numbers, but you're probably making $6 or $7 million in a given year. You know, if you're in the top few, you're making 4 or 5 times that. $15 million probably just isn't that big of a liability to him. And I don't think he should think that it's a big liability to him. Now, of course, people have talked about him going live, and I think that would certainly be just a really quick part, maybe the first bullet point on the contract of like, yep, that insurance policy, like, Yas has got it. I think that would go away ASAP. What I've heard about his potential live contract is it would be similar to what I completely was just making up potentially about Surratt, but could be the case of like short term, Let's see how it goes. And then if it goes pretty well, there'll be something longer term. In fact, I don't know if free agent was the term they used. I feel like it was more of like floater or something of the like, but apparently he may or may not even be on a team this year if he ends up doing live, and he would just be able to compete in the events as an individual, which is completely and utterly antithetical to live. Like I'm calling
that's a team
bullshit.
Sport. Here. What are we doing here?
Right. Like this is a team sport. That's what the whole thing is about. I mean, ask Bubba, ask Gooch, ask any of these guys.
These guys love it.
These guys are crying in the club about the team situation. And we got AK coming back, tattoos and all, potentially not being a member of the team. Like, what the fuck is going on?
You know,
on
the
here?
Biggest anyway. Team guy of them all is Perez. That guy rides for the team model.
If we talk about the team model, Pat Perez has been cleaning up. You know, going back to, I gave Richard Bland just an absolute drive-by there.
Yeah, he did, but
I mean, I think that bullet probably went through Blandy and straight into Perez because he is on that chopping block somewhere. I digress. If Anthony Kim goes live, apparently that's what we may be seeing. If he doesn't go live, apparently he does. He still would have major medical status. I guess that's a thing that it's like, it's not a 365 day endeavor. It's like a tournament to tournament endeavor. It's like you have, you know,
once
between
you come back,
your
you have
final
time.
Tournament. Exactly. And like, he hasn't played since. And so he would have status there. But the other thing is like, now would he be able to get into the elevated events? I think the answer is no, because you can't just sponsor exemption your way through those. But I mean, who the hell is not using their sponsor's exemptions outside of the elevated events on Anthony Kim? So I don't think that there's going to be any difficulty of access there. I mentioned the PIF, like that's not nothing. When you're a guy that's making your way back. And I mean, I think he would absolutely clean up. I mean, think about it this way, like a guy that people have been scratching and clawing over like six data points over the last 12 years, like anytime a picture or a swing video or anything comes across the airwaves, people are like, oh my God, he's back.
That's right.
If he decided to like hashtag engage in the content game, can you imagine? I don't say this as like a brag or anything, but just realistically, other than of course the cat, like we're not talking about the cat. I don't think I follow a single professional golfer on Instagram.
Yeah.
I would follow Anthony Kim and I would want to see everything that that guy is up to.
All right. You're kind of working into two questions that I had. And we're getting a little long in the tooth here. I want to make sure we get these hit. The first one is Anthony Kim took a little hiatus. I mean, a big hiatus. We haven't seen anything on him. You were just speaking on it on social media. Was that tied into his contract? Was he not allowed to, for lack of a better term, use his name, image, and likeness to continue making money online? Second is the Nike deal. Tiger's gone away from Nike. What is AK going to be sporting?
These are both really great questions that neither of which I have an answer to, but of course I always have bullshit to throw at any question. That's, so
yeah,
when it comes to the social media stuff, I think there's probably truth in both camps of, I think you're definitely barking up the right tree that maybe he wasn't able to use his name, image, and likeness off of the game of golf to make any money. I think you're probably exactly right there. I also think that it was just kind of like came with the territory of like, I'm going off the grid. So bye bye grid. And then on the second one, I mean, look, all signs are pointing to Nike Golf within 18 or 20 months. And this is pure speculation. Please, nobody quote me or get mad at me on this, but I think Nike Golf could be like completely and utterly dissolved. I don't think Nike as an overall entity is exactly adding things up day to day. But golf has never been a very profitable segment for them. And so I think that they're just like, let's just go apply those resources elsewhere. Yeah, with Cat going away, I mean, what's the true bedrock of that? I don't know. Maybe I go the other direction and say, you just lean in on AK, make him your new gamer and see where that takes you. That said, is Anthony Kim not the perfect Malbon Golf guy?
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. Jay Day needs to reconsider.
Yeah, like that's a no.
Except we're still long on Jay Day. I'm still long on Jay Day this year. You don't have to claim that one, but
long on Jay Day, just not the Malbon pants. But AK could wear anything.
AK could wear anything. Yeah, he's got the skater vibe. The whole thing's really well set up for him, I think.
That AK is actually, this is awesome. AK is actually what golf has maybe been missing in this whole new trendy clothing wear. Like, I'm not saying that he's swaying. I'm not saying he's swaying me to start buying Malbon. I'm not saying he's swaying the 54-year-old country club golfer to buy Malbon. Mm-hmm. I do think that he is the potential, like, proof of concept. Like, yes, there is in fact a market here. Like, Malbon to me feels like they're currently creating a product that, like, I'm not saying you're making a bad product or the wrong product. It's just that product market fit is 3 years down the line. You know, it's just a tale as old as time. It's like, go to the VC meeting and they're like, guys, like, I love what we have here. There's a great management team, great product. Product market fit is 3 years away. You guys are early. Bench this one. Stick to your 9 to 5. Keep on riding it. That's Malbon Golf to me. AK is the just like full-blown accentuation of product market fit. When he comes, outfit him in Malbon Golf. You're going to have kids, people everywhere just like, yes, get me in some Malbon.
I have to say, I was at their booth on Friday. I'd never held the product in my hands physically. And as you know, with clothes, that kind of matters a lot. I'm a big fan of what they're doing over there. I'm not saying that I'm the product market fit. Like, I don't know if we would represent.
You are.
I don't know if we would represent Malbon Golf to the best. Certainly not as well as AK could, but the product is really good.
Awfully humble.
And
if
the
you
house
say.
And the house theory is off the chain. Their booth was unlike any other.
Speaking my language now.
Mudball Monday. Thanks for tuning in. We've got a lot of scoop in the year 2024. We've got a lot of dirt in the year 2024. We've got more episodes coming out. Michael Woods joins us this week to talk a little bit about turf grass. We're making turf grass and the management of the turf that you play on applicable to the daily enjoyer of the game of golf. Michael is palatable. He's a turf scientist, and he did a great job explaining simply how his research is affecting courses from your local muni all the way up to the best courses in the world get tournament ready and the inputs that go into that. So look for that on Thursday, 8 p.m. ET. I've got a piece coming out on Wednesday. We've got more writing coming your way in weeks to come. And we'll keep you posted.